Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see a full house here today on this beautiful fall afternoon at the Hilton Hotel. We are so glad that you are joining us, and if you wouldn't mind to take a moment to just to turn off your cell phones, today's program is being recorded for the radio. And we do love your ringtones, but the radio listeners would appreciate if you'd put it on vibrate. We'd like to thank Kari for doing the recording for Alaska World Affairs Council and KSKA. And you'll be able to listen to this program as well as all of our previous programs either through a link on our website or directly at alaskapublic.org. We are a membership organization, so if you're currently not a member, please consider joining the World Affairs Council and supporting our programs. We have a full season this year, almost twice as many programs as last year. So if you haven't picked up our brochure, we just started. We hope to see you at all of our upcoming programs. And we have right now a generous contribution or sponsorship from the Atwood Foundation, where they are offering matching grants for anyone who becomes a $1,000 or more member of the World Affairs Council. They will match you dollar for dollar up to $20,000. So we are now at 10. We can have 20 people to take advantage of this. Please help us take advantage of this great opportunity from the Atwood Foundation. We also have some military personnel, and we're so glad to see you here today. We have a generous donor, Nader, who is sponsoring our military friends, as well as BP, who is sponsoring our students. I saw a bunch of people from Central Middle School, and I rode the elevator with some great folks from UAA. If you wouldn't mind standing, if you are a student, we are so happy you're here. Please stand and give us a wave. Wow, thank you so much for coming. And thank you, BP, for sponsoring our students. We'd like to encourage all of our students and everyone to check out our Facebook page, like us, follow us, tweet about us. You can even take a couple snapshots of you and your friends and post it. We'd love to see what you guys think and what you're doing. We do appreciate everyone to RSVP for our upcoming programs. We have a book at the front door desk. We just got in from our speaker who's coming on the 14th of November. We already have 150 people who have RSVP'd for this program. So if you're not one of those 150 people, please do so today. And his book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve: Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. And he's going to be talking about our dictators getting smarter. So please join us for that program as well as our others. You can register directly online and you'll get a discount on your registration if you do that early. We also have coming up October 16th, the second popular World Whiz Pub Trivia Night. So if you are over 21 and you know something about beer or geography or paparazzi or current events or something like that, you are perfect for this fun-filled event at the Taproot. Go to our website and you can see information about this fun fundraiser as well as registration. And then we are going to be in the evening on October 29th at the Wendy Williamson, where we're going to be showing a movie about human trafficking, what that looks like around the world and all of its different forms, and have a panel discussion afterwards. So we hope to see you then. At this time, I'd like to bring Jeremy, if he is still around, with our tickets to see who won our bread basket. Has he left? Okay, Alyssa, it looks like you're holding the lucky ticket. We can ask our speaker to pull the winning ticket for our bread basket today. Thank you very much. If you have number 904013, you won a basket full of goodies from Great Harvest Bread Company, 904013. No, I think that's the first. Ah, congratulations, you won a bread basket. And I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, I have William Toyer, who you have seen for many years in the corner recording for us for KSKA, former board member of the World Affairs Council. We're so glad to have him join us here at the head table. Thank you for all that you've done for our organization. And to his right, we have Mr. Greg Wolf, also another former board member of the World Affairs Council. You probably know him as the director of the World Trade Center Alaska. I'd like to bring him up to the podium to introduce our speaker. Greg.
Thank you, Lise. And we're always very happy to partner with the Alaska World Affairs Council for these types of events, particularly when they are focusing on China. I think everyone in this room knows that China has become, in the past several years, Alaska's largest trading partner. Last year, our exports to China totaled $1.2 billion. And they continue to grow in importance to us, not only as a buyer of what we export, but we're seeing increasing interest by Chinese companies in making investments in Alaska. So this relationship is growing and expanding each year. As Lise mentioned, my name is Greg Wolf. I'm the executive director of the World Trade Center Alaska here in Anchorage. And I'd like to introduce our speaker today, who is Dr. Ron Tammen. Ron Tammen is a professor of political science and the director of the Mark O. Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. In previous positions, he served as associate dean and chair of the Department of National Strategy at the National War College. He served as chief of staff to Senator William Proxmire and was a staff consultant to the Arms Control and Foreign Policy Caucus, headed then by Senator Mark Hatfield. In the private sector, Dr. Tammen was managing partner of the Potomac Partners, a national public relations and lobbying firm based in Washington, D.C., that represented major clients in banking, aerospace, food, environment, and technology arenas. Dr. Tammen specializes in world politics, with a particular reference to power relationships among the great powers, present and future. His research centers on world politics with an emphasis on the emergence of China and India as world powers. This is a central theme of his latest book, Power Transition Strategies for the 21st Century, which he co-authored with several other leading academics. He is also the author of MERV and the Arms Race and editor of The Economics of Military Spending. Dr. Tammen is here today to speak on the subject of Will China Rule the World? Please join me in welcoming back to Anchorage and to the Alaska World Affairs Council, Dr. Tammen.
Thank you, Lise and Greg. It's a distinct pleasure for me to be here with you in Alaska, and I thank the World Affairs Council for the courtesy of giving me this opportunity. So what is the most important question facing the world today? Is it the Russians seizing parts of the Ukraine or the Crimea? Is it nuclear weapons in Iran or North Korea? Is it the continuing warfare in the Middle East, the crisis du jour? If you're a strategic thinker, if you think long term, the answer to these questions is no, none of the above. The most important question facing the world today is what will happen if and when China becomes extraordinarily powerful? So, for us, will China overtake the United States in economic and military power? I'm going to give you an answer, but I'm going to put you to work in helping me find the solution to that. I'll give you a first cut at this. Don't be silly. Of course they will. First in economic power and then in military power. So let's look at the facts. China has 1.2, 1.3 billion people. The United States, 300 million. That means that the average Chinese worker need only be one-fourth as productive as the average U.S. worker for China to have a GDP equal to that of the United States. So I want to see a show of hands from my audience and those that are listening by radio. How many of you out there say it is impossible, it'll never happen, that the average Chinese worker will be one quarter as productive as the average U.S. worker. So all the skeptics, not a hand has gone up. You know what you've just told me? You've told me that their economy is, at some point in the future, going to be as large as that of the United States. Now, what if the average Chinese worker is one half as productive? Then their economy is twice the size. Is that impossible? What happens if the average Chinese worker is as productive as a worker in Japan or Norway or Europe, anywhere? Then their economy is 4 to 5 times that of the United States. That's a staggering consideration, to be living in a world where another country outweighs you by a ratio of 4 or 5 to 1 in terms of economic power. So when will this happen? My estimate when I wrote about this in 1988 was the year 2015. The Economist magazine tells us it's going to be 2019. Goldman Sachs thinks it's off into 2027. The World Bank likes 2015 as well. So whatever the date, it's now a commonly accepted fact that one day soon, Americans will wake up to the headlines that read, China overtakes the United States in economic power. Their economy has grown 7 times as fast as the U.S. over the past 10 years. Put another way, they've had 30 years of 8 to 10% growth, and we struggle to achieve 3%. That said, China will still have a long way to go to catch up to GDP per capita. Right now, GDP per capita income for the U.S. is around $50,000, while China is $9,000. Per capita income measures personal wealth. National GDP measures the money available to the central government for investment in the economy or the military or both. So keep your eye on gross GDP numbers. They are extraordinarily important. The Chinese workforce, it's dynamic and growing. They have a floating workforce, not their permanent workforce, but a floating workforce of 150 million, mainly men. What's the entire workforce of the United States? The entire workforce, 155 million. Every day, more inefficient rural workers are becoming efficient, productive urban workers in China. China is building 20 new cities, twice the size of Anchorage, per year. A few are unoccupied. You may have seen the pictures of a ghost city in China. But they have a plan to fix that. They're going to move people in from the rural areas. In fact, the greatest migration in human history is about to occur in China, as up to 400 million rural Chinese are moved, willingly or unwillingly, to cities. There'll be 1 billion Chinese living in urban areas in 2030. They will have 221 cities over 1 million population each. How many cities in the United States have over 1 million? Somebody like to give me an estimate? Give me a number, anybody. Any number. Sir, give me a number.
25.
25. 9. Wait. But you're in the ballpark. And it doesn't compare to 221. Think of that. Here's another small number out of China. 21% of China is under the age of 14. Now, that doesn't sound like a large percentage. But if you take the gross number, it's greater than the population of the United Kingdom and France and Italy and Germany combined. Driven by the need for foreign resources and fueled by competition with the United States, The Chinese military is undergoing a sustained technologically driven growth curve. They have 800 short-range ballistic missiles pointed at Taiwan as we speak today. They're developing a second strike strategic force. You remember that term from the Cold War? It means they can absorb a nuclear attack on the homeland, China, and retaliate in force. They have the second largest defense budget in the world, the largest land army. They have announced strategies to protect the sea lanes to the Middle East, to deny Taiwan independence, to exploit the South China Sea, and they will and have maintained peaceful borders by force, if necessary. And they've also shown the disposition to quell domestic opposition from minority populations, be they Tibetan, Uyghur, Mongolian, or Kazakh. Make no mistake about it. Even if China suffers a cataclysmic setback, they will still become the most powerful country in the world. Nonsense, you say. But I would argue countries can recover from the unthinkable. Consider Germany and Japan. They were defeated in war, had their countries occupied by foreign forces, had new forms of government imposed upon them. They suffered huge population losses. They were set back economically by vast destruction of their infrastructure, cataclysmic events all. And within 20 years, these countries recovered to their dynamic pre-war growth rates. Now let's take a pause for a minute. Perhaps I'm not being fair in this analysis. Perhaps I'm being terribly one-sided. After all, there are renowned experts in government and in the academic world that argue that China, while continuing to grow somewhat, will fail to become the world's leading power. So I'm willing to be convinced. I presume you are as well. Let's hear out their arguments. And I'm going to stipulate in advance, I'm going to agree with all their arguments. So what do they argue? They say the Communist Party is losing support in rural areas. There's evidence of that. There's criticism of the party. It's muted, but it is creeping into print. They argue that democracy may prevail over time, and democracies don't fight. Some local elections are occurring right now under somewhat democratic means. There may be top-down reforms as well. And with democratic reforms, China may no longer feel the need to compete for international power. Or the country could fracture like the Soviet Union did. Look at Tibet and Xinjiang provinces today with the unrest there. Or the overheated real estate economy could crash as the housing and occupancy crisis currently portends. Already we see these ghost buildings and ghost cities and deserted theme cities. Or an aging population might stress the financial integrity of China. China could go the way of Japan and parts of Europe with too few supporting too many. By 2020, the ratio of workers to retirees will be 3-1. Leading to one-third of China's population being over 60 by 2040. The one-child policy that you all know about has mandated, in effect, that one child and spouse will end up supporting four parents plus grandparents. That's a huge economic burden on a country. Healthcare. It's a vast and expensive potential drag on the Chinese economy. They do not have any form of universal health care. Pollution. Waterways are polluted. Cities have particulates so thick that visibility is limited to a single block. Forests have been cut down. Animal species extirpated. 8-20% of all arable land is contaminated with heavy metals and therefore unusable for agricultural purposes. Many studies indicate that pollution will have significant economic and health consequences for China. Pollution's expensive to remediate after the fact, as we all know. water shortages. The Tibetan glaciers that supply China's great rivers are disappearing by 7% a year. Not an unfamiliar thing to Alaskans, perhaps. Half of the rivers that existed in China, half, in 1990, have dried up. No water. 75% of those that remain are polluted. Energy shortages, they could curtail the growth in China. And new sources of energy that China is now tapping are in the Middle East, highly unreliable area. There could be regional disputes between the have and have-not provinces, the rich eastern provinces, the relatively poor western provinces. That could curtail growth and could foster regional frictions. The banking system in China is rife with bad loans based on non-producing real estate, particularly by state-owned industry and by party officials. Loans that are never going to be paid off. This could cascade into an economic collapse of the country, much like it did in Southeast Asia in 1997. Could be bird flu or a swine contagion that could cause severe economic dislocations, creating quarantines and mass deaths and economic stagnation in China. Or there could be a civil war or a regional war with India as a result of any of these factors I just mentioned. And corruption. Corruption's endemic to China. It could crush the entrepreneurial spirit there and foster severe discontent among the general population. When the princes and princelings race around the country in their Maseratis and Ferraris, occasionally running over a local peasant, it confirms that society has become corrupt and uneven in China. The gender imbalance, it's creating a population of surplus men. Eventually, 1 in 5 Chinese men will be hopelessly single. So young ladies in the crowd here, if you're looking for a mate, head west. This could cause enormous social disruption. Any one of these challenges could bring down a country. And in concert, it is argued, it would be impossible to overcome them. So, are you convinced now that China faces such challenges that they can never really compete with the U.S.? Let me just see a show of hands at this point. I am convinced that those challenges are insurmountable. Very good. All right, now let's just take a third cut at this. Let's take a snapshot of the United States before the end of the 20th century, at the turn of the century, early 1900s. Okay, what did the United States look like? We just come through a disastrous civil war, which created long-term fissures in society, a large regional war, which destroyed transportation, agriculture, and industry. We were busy polluting our streams and rivers. We were cutting down entire forests. We were killing off the last of the bison. We were destroying the environment. Smoke was covering the northern cities from Chicago through Illinois and Ohio. Rivers were burning with effluent. There were 13 fires in the Cuyahoga River alone, beginning in 1868, the river catching on fire. Oligarchs are running the country, railroad and financial barons, a few wealthy families controlling production. It's an uneven society. Gould, Harriman, Hill, Mellon, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, Carnegie, John Jacob Astor, all with their own princes and princelings driving around the country. There's vast wealth for a few, poverty for many immigrants and rural Americans. There are race riots in the major cities, lynchings in the South, a society in turmoil. There's severe anti-immigrant frictions, religious bigotry, anti-Catholic demonstrations, signs on businesses that say, no Jews, no blacks, no Irish, no Germans, no Italians, please. But the signs weren't quite that polite, as you all understand. There's vast corruption at all levels of government. Tammany Hall, big city machines like Chicago, vote buying, corruption of senators and House members, cabinet members, the judiciary, the police forces. There are payoffs and bribes galore. Pandemics. There are huge outbreaks of influenza, polio, cholera, dysentery, malaria, TB, typhoid fever, yellow fever. High death rates for children and the elderly. 675,000 people die of Spanish flu in 1918 alone. 50 million worldwide. You remember typhoid Mary working in the houses of the rich on the East Coast? The start of a healthcare revolution. Smallpox, meanwhile, has devastated Native American populations from an estimated 12 million to 237,000 in the early 1900s. Healthcare? Not a chance for most. Gender imbalance? Certainly the case in the Western United States and particularly in Alaska. What would you conclude from taking this snapshot? What would you think? Inevitably, you should think, this country will never succeed. It will never make it. There are too many intractable problems, any one of which could bring it down, but taken in concert, impossible to overcome. So, we come to this. Is the United States so unique, so special, so industrious, so exceptional, that it could survive all of these challenges while China, in similar circumstances, will fail? What do you think? What does it mean if I'm correct about China becoming the most powerful country in the world? Well, early on, after the collapse of the USSR, the United States suffered through a decade of what I call the decade of enemy deprivation. This eventually gave way to two different camps regarding China, the conflict versus cooperation camps, or strategic engagement and strategic competition, Clinton versus Bush. And subsequently, we've had President Obama with the pivot toward Asia. And this pivot is one of the most important foreign policy initiatives of the post-Soviet era and the least well-known. So how are the Chinese responding? They have a saying, strong economy, strong army. They've seen what happened to the Soviet Union. They've seen what happened to the United States. And they've decided that they are going to invest first in the economy, knowing that then, if necessary, they could take the proceeds from that and make a strong army. They've adopted a page from our American political history. And they've done it in very subtle ways. They've gone around their border resolving border disputes, which helps create a launch pad for the greater world. They're very good at international posturing using slogans, but each of these have a clever secondary message. So when they talk about non-interference in the affairs of other countries and they lecture other countries about this, what they're really saying is don't interfere with us as well. They talk about peaceful rising and peaceful development to try to reassure the people in the neighborhood. What do Chinese leaders really think and how are they influenced by their own history? It's extraordinarily difficult to get in the mind of a Chinese leader or any leader around the world for that matter. So I'm going to ask you to try to put yourself in the shoes of a major Chinese leader. What domestic events have conditioned your worldview? Well, you've lived through the Great Leap Forward, where 700 million Chinese were placed in communes from 1958 to 1960. Building backyard furnaces to match the U.S. steel output by 1988 was the goal. You lived through the Red Guard period from 1966 to 76, called the Cultural Revolution. It touched almost every family in China. And how do you view where you live? I was at a military facility in southern China on a trip sponsored by our State Department and the Chinese People's Liberation Army, going to a firepower demonstration there. And they took me to their local military museum. And the museum was a series of walls with photographs. And they explained to me that the photographs were of the military officers from this unit who had died in service of China. The first wall had everyone who had been killed from that unit who served in Tibet in 1951. The second wall, Korea, fighting the Americans, they said, in 50 to 53. The third wall, Vietnam, 59 to 75. The fourth wall, fighting the Indians in 62. The fifth wall, fighting the Soviet Union in 69. And the last wall, fighting the Vietnamese again in 1979. By the way, the Vietnamese acquitted themselves quite well in that war. Now look geographically as this fictitious Chinese leader. You look north, there's a nuclear power, North Korea, plus the United States occupying South Korea. You look west, another nuclear power, Russia, that betrayed the revolution. You look south, two nuclear powers, with Pakistan and India, plus Vietnam. You look east, and you see a floating Western aircraft carrier called Taiwan, plus hated Japan. How would you react if Canada and Mexico were hostile and had nuclear weapons, and if British Columbia were an independent country with nukes run by an unpredictable and perhaps irrational leader? Internally, you see unrest in Tibet and unrest in Xinjiang. You see foreign hands meddling, the Dalai Lama, Turkey supporting the Uyghurs, radical Islamists, Western religions, cults, the internet, Western concepts of the law and human rights, infections all, cancers that must be cut out. You understand the threat of 150 million men internal workforce, and which must at all costs be kept employed. And that demands that your economy grow at 8% a year or more. And you see the threat of the free enterprise sector eroding the power of the party. And above all else, that is unacceptable. You not only see, but you remember. You remember the time of troubles, the two opium wars of 1839 to 42 and 1856 to 60, resulting in the unequal treaties, the loss of Hong Kong, humiliation and weakness. You remember the Boxer Rebellion of 1900. Which brought further humiliation, and the Western interventions and concessions. You call this something special. You call this the period of swallowing bitterness. You remember the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 31, the rape of Nanking in 37. You remember the Japanese military unit 37, which practiced vivisection on Chinese prisoners. You remember the Great Patriotic Civil War and how the Americans sided with the wrong side. You remember crossing the Yalu River when your warnings were disregarded by the Americans. More recently, you were embarrassed to have to back down in a series of crises over Taiwan. You continue to swallow bitterness, but you have patience because you know your time is coming. So what must the world be ready for? A different set of rules of the road, an Asian-based set of rules. We can follow the money. Chinese investments abroad will be followed by Chinese diplomatic support for those investments, which will be followed by Chinese military support for your diplomatic and economic investments. There's already evidence of this in the Middle East. What is the best we can hope for? We can hope that Chinese leaders become socialized into the international system that exists today in such a way that little will change when their power increases exponentially, much as what happened when the U.S. assumed the mantle of world leadership from the United Kingdom. If this is to happen, then it is the special obligation of the U.S. business community to bring this about. Unlike during the Cold War, where there were no business ties between the Russians and the Americans, reciprocal business relationships between China and the U.S., which I call golden handcuffs, will have a moderating influence on Chinese power and may help to change the nature of Chinese governance as well. None of this will matter, however, if the U.S. pursues a posture of alienating or provoking the Chinese during their fast growth period. If they have to continue swallowing bitterness when they are ultimately powerful, they will reorganize the international system based on their own principles, and they will replace the post-World War II world that in large measure we designed and instituted. So with that uplifting thought, I will leave you for the afternoon and be glad to take your questions. Thank you very much.
Dr. Tomlin has agreed to take some questions. If you wouldn't mind just waiting for the microphone, like I said, we are recording for the radio. Kari will bring you the microphone for the questions.
Thank you for your presentation. In recent international news, conclusions have been expressed that the current action of the U.S. government has now driven China and Russia into closer alliance. Considering your in-depth military expertise, hypothetically, if a conflict should erupt between the global superpowers, would China side with the USA or Russia?
It would depend on what the conflict is all about. China is not in the habit currently of creating alliances that require military intervention by their own troops. The Chinese and the Russians don't really like each other. They've been pushed together by geopolitical factors, but it would be a very temporary alliance and a very unsatisfactory one to both sides. So I don't fear that. Coupled with the fact that China is an economic giant and Russia is an economic basket case, that even changes the equation more. The Russian economy has improved slightly under Putin, but is still in a sustained nosedive since the revolution of 1990. The average longevity for a Russian man is declining year by year for various health reasons, including one of the highest rates of alcoholism ever known to mankind. So Russia has its problems. And I don't fear a combination of Russia and China because they are two siblings that will never get along.
Obviously, the last few days, there's been a lot of attention paid to the developments in Hong Kong. And it would seem that China is much more integrated into the world economy than it was at the time of Tiananmen Square. When the British colony was essentially incorporated into China with different rules, that seemed to be an unsustainable tension. What do you see as the likely short-term developments and maybe looking a little farther down the road, assuming that they can, you know, kind of shuffle their way through the current unrest?
In the short term, I think both sides understand the value of tamping down the friction and controlling it without overt measures, without intervention by force. But you shouldn't make a mistake. If the leadership in Beijing feels that the power of the party is being threatened by this, if they see spontaneous demonstrations in other cities in China, we've already seen a small one in Macau, for example, and they feel the threat to the role of the party, they will use force. They will accept a 3 or 4 or 5 year period of time of international condemnation and economic difficulties. The power of the party is not a negotiable issue for the leadership in China. So while we might say that times have changed, but that has not changed.
Long term, will a capitalist economic system grafted on to a communist political system work? Isn't that the $64 million question?
That is one of the most important questions in this whole equation. Right now, Chinese leaders are driving a car, and they've got 1 foot on the accelerator and 1 foot on the brake. And we're all waiting, standing by to see how the car is effectively driven. The foot on the accelerator is the economy, and the foot on the brake is the party. Will the market freedoms bleed over into the political side of the equation? Most experts think that they will, and that it will have a corrosive impact on the positive side of that word. In terms of internal politics, because to do business in China, you're going to need lawyers, you're going to need courts that can adjudicate disputes and resolve disputes, you're going to need some semblance of acceptability of the decisions of the court so that there's no behind the scenes control by the party itself. Those things could develop over time, and many China experts expect that. I guess I'm less sanguine. I think that the party will maintain its controls. It might evolve gradually over 20 or 30 years into something more along the Singapore model, but I don't see that happening quickly or without friction.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation. As a Chinese, I would like to ask you a question, because based on your facts, are always kind of those numbers are from external to look at the facts and to analyze those facts. But in my opinion, that the two systems, the U.S. system and the Chinese system, whether one will dominate another one, it depends on whether the system itself would work. And I just would like to tap into your brain and how do you see the Chinese system will work in the sense that I'm a Chinese, I live in that country for a long time, I live in this side for a long time, and I see that their internal system would collapse if there's a war or there's military force being used.
Again, a significant and an important question, and my crystal ball doesn't always have answers to everything, but I can speculate about this. The society in China is changing as the Chinese develop a segment of their population that is middle class. A middle-class society makes different demands on its government than a peasant society. Right now, with 800 million peasants, that's, and I'm using their term, not an American term, for the people that work on farms in China. That's a particular problem of its own. But a middle class is a consumer class and inevitably asks for more rights as consumers, and more rights to be heard, and more rights for redress of grievance. I think that and the development of nonprofit organizations, I don't see another party developing in China. That won't be allowed, but the creation of nonprofit organizations and business organizations may eventually grow enough in power internally that they share power with the leadership and put a constraint on the power of the leadership. I think that's the most promising avenue for China to move forward without open rebellion or warfare, which I really don't think will happen.
China, obviously, having become the second largest economic power, having a seat on the and a veto on the Security Council, has the potential to be a major player globally in diplomatic affairs and so on. Mainly up to now, they've sort of used their veto to enforce this idea of national borders being sacrosanct in the sense that nobody can internationally interfere with their governance or anything. But is there anything that you see on the horizon that would make China a larger participant or more constructive player in the international community, like protecting shipping lanes, the Somali pirates and so on, particularly when they're looking overseas for so much of their resources and energy?
Yes, it's happening, and it's inevitable in many ways. As they move into the broader international community for economic reasons, to import oil and gas, they're signing up long-term oil and gas leases and have for almost 10 years now in the Middle East. They're also buying land in Africa. They're not just going after rare trace minerals, which we need for electronics, but also for agricultural purposes. If you travel in Africa, you see Chinese workers in many countries now being sent there to build roads and dams. They are drawn into the world, whether they want to or not. And their military presence is going to increase accordingly. All this should have a moderating influence on China. Furthermore, they're joining multilateral organizations in Southeast Asia, in Asia, which means that they have to hear the complaints of their neighbors, and they have to get along with their neighbors. And again, that's a moderating impact on them, and a very positive one. But behind all this is the ability to wield force if and when necessary. And we can't forget their history about Tibet, for example, or any other threat to them, quote-unquote threat to them on their border. They will use force, and they will justify it as being an internal matter. So I do think there's a way forward, combining the last two questions, to put these golden handcuffs on China so that as their power develops, they have a responsible leadership world and maybe share that with their neighbors and with other United Nations. The United Nations needs reorganizing, by the way. Members of the Security Council do not any longer reflect the distribution of power in this world. They reflect the snapshot of the world in 1949, but no longer today. Japan and India should be on the Security Council. Our great friends, the Brits and the French, perhaps not, although I'm not going to go there and tell them that.
Thank you very much. Most fascinating. I was in Urumqi about 4 years ago, and the internet was shut down. The Uyghur were in full rebellion. The Han and the Uyghur have deep, deep historical issues. How do you see this playing out with the minorities of Chinese society?
The Uyghur population in Xinjiang province, the Tibetan population in Tibet proper and the provinces surrounding Tibet are a distinct and serious internal threat to the Chinese leadership. And they have responded with a strategy that I don't think has been fully enunciated internationally. They are intent on assimilating those populations. And I mean by assimilation, as an example, Lhasa, Tibet, where I was last year. There's tall 10-story apartment buildings going up all over Lhasa, empty rooms right now, all to be filled with Chinese immigrants. The population of Tibet used to be 80% Tibetan and 20% Chinese. Now a lot of estimates think it may be 50-50 or maybe the Chinese in the majority. They disallow the teaching of Tibetan in schools. They are, in effect, going to assimilate that population as rapidly as they can, which will take a generation or two. And one day, I think visitors to Tibet will see Tibetan culture only in the dance show at the local Hilton Hotel on Saturday night, because the Chinese will have assimilated the society as a whole. And this is nothing new in Chinese history. When they've moved west in the past, they've always done the same thing, taken over land and gradually integrated those populations. The we Chinese, for example, today reflect this same pattern, what has happened by assimilating a Muslim population that is now more or less loyal Chinese population.
Last question.
Thank you very much for a fantastic presentation. I have a few questions. The first, do you think that with the rise of China, we'll have a multipolar world or a unipolar world? The second, I attended a presentation at Stanford last year. Richard asked the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said, and I quote, "If we are not willing or able to lead this century, it will be the messiest one in the history of the humanity. No one else has the capacity, the habit, and the values of leading the world. I don't see an alternative to us. The only one will be fairly negative." What would you comment on that, us being the United States?
Well, it is clear and unequivocally clear that the United States has been the leader of the world community in terms of forming new international organizations in the aftermath of World War II, new international trade organizations, creating the rules of the road that the rest of the world has accepted. I think it's critically important for the United States to continue to do that going forward in time for as long as is practical. Now, that last phrase is a loaded phrase. It means that over time, gradually, with the development of a new superpower in the world, that we have to integrate that new power into the structures that we've already created and to make sure that they have a role rather than to try to freeze them out, to try to encircle them, to try to change their policies, or try to intervene in their domestic affairs. All those would be drastic mistakes. Instead, we have to be smarter and much more subtle and use the countries in that part of the world as part of our strategy to wrap them into a pattern of acceptable behavior that the entire world community would find beneficial in the long run. We still set many of the international standards, and the world does look to us to resolve far too many problems, perhaps. That is not going to go away because our military power is without parallel in the world, and the power development of China will come in two stages, with economics first, and then military power generated down the road after that. So we're really talking about a world, at least in my presentation today, that begins in 2035 or 2040, when China has then reached the point where it can unilaterally make the rules of the road in some dimensions internationally.
Super.
Thank you very much.